This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We'd like to stop and catch our breath, but there's New York and Colorado, the recount that never stops in Minnesota, and, yes, Illinois, time for a Christmas Eve visit with the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about the week in politics and to plug his blog. This week, the president-elect is on vacation, but Team Obama reports itself completely clean in the Blagojevich mess. Senate appointments still open in three states, one as yet undecided Senate election. A bit later, we'll review one of the most remarkable political years in memory, and we have an email challenge for you. Compose your version of "Twas the Night Before Christmas." The senators both nestled all snug in their beds with visions of White House filling their heads. Write your version and email it to us, talk@npr.org. Now, yours does not have to be about politics. Hey, what rhymes with Tashira? And again, the address is talk@npr.org. Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A, and while the political junkie usually starts us off with a trivia question, this week he has a poem for us. Does it begin with "twas"? We'll get to that a bit later. In the meantime, what's your favorite, funniest, wowiest political moment of 2008? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can email us. That address again is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Again, we're reviewing the great political moments of the year. But Ken, let's start with news of this past week. Any movement on the Senate seats in New York, Colorado, or what's rapidly becoming known as the recount state, Minnesota?
Yes.
And would you fill us in?
Oh, yes. Well, okay. Well, in Minnesota, for example, they have counted all the disputed ballots. And right now, for the first time, Al Franken, the Democratic challenger, has a 47-vote lead. We always talk about whether every vote counts. It certainly counts in Minnesota. But the Secretary of State says there probably will not be any declared winner, not only by the end of the year. Now, the canvassing board doesn't meet until December 30th, but even before January 6th, when the new Senate is sworn in. So there are still 1,600 absentee ballots that have been rejected for one reason or another. And so now both camps, the Secretary of State says both camps, both the Norm Coleman and the Al Franken camp, have to agree on whether to reinstate these 1,600 votes. Most likely, Minnesota will go into the 111th Congress with just one senator, that's Amy Klobuchar. We will not have a winner declared before January 6th.
Okay, and we have no clue as to when we might have another senator from Illinois.
No, not at all. The Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney who's investigating Governor Rod Blagojevich, has told the impeachment committee in the Illinois state legislature that the U.S. attorney's office is not going to supply any information because they don't want that to compromise their own investigation. So I have a sense that the impetus for what's going to happen to Blagojevich may not come from the General Assembly or the legislature, but from Patrick Fitzgerald's office. But meanwhile, there's been no indictment as of yet. But again, when you heard that he was arrested on December 9th on many charges, including the alleged selling of a U.S. Senate seat. And of course, that's what got the Obama team releasing their report yesterday.
Okay, we are taking calls today on the most important political moments of 2008. Give us your nominee, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. The other Senate seats that are open, New York, Caroline Kennedy, still the leading contender there?
Well, maybe. It's interesting now that, you know, she's been talked about most and a lot of people are saying it's all but a done deal. That seems to be the word coming out of Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, his camp, because they're working very close with Caroline Kennedy. And there seems to be some resentment, some reaction that you're putting undue pressure on David Paterson. After all, that's the only vote that counts in New York and to be decided by the governor of New York. And while Caroline Kennedy is doing her upstate Hillary Clinton-like tour, listening tour,
yes.
But she's not talking. She's listening, but not talking. She's not talking to the press. She's really not talking to many voters, and she's really not answering many questions. So there are a lot of people talking about entitlement, and then, you know, she's getting this because she's a Kennedy and for no other reason. And there's no shortage of other Democrats who really want the seat, members of Congress, the Long Island, the Nassau County executive on Long Island, perhaps the mayor of Buffalo, a whole bunch of names Republicans are in that. But there seems to be some pushback from Democrats saying, wait a second, this is not a coronation. This is she is not entitled to this seat.
And there she did answer some written questions supplied by The New York Times, Politico.com and some others, laying out some positions, which in terms of the ones she provided, seem to be pretty standard Democrat, New York Democrat territory.
Except when she was asked whether she would endorse or she support the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City in 2009, she hemmed and hawed on that, and for the reason is because she's very closely linked with Mayor Bloomberg, who will run on God knows what party, right, probably as an independent.
First ran as a Republican, now an independent.
Right.
So anyway, and Colorado, any movement there?
No, but that's the one when Ken Salazar has been named to be the next Secretary of Interior, and Governor Bill Ritter, a Democrat in Colorado, says he has plenty of time to make his choice. John Salazar, the Senator's brother, who is a congressman, is one of the people mentioned. John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver, is on the list, as well as Ed Perlmutter. Again, there's no lead, but of course, unlike New York and unlike Illinois, there seems to be no controversy in Colorado.
And we have to go revisit, perhaps, one of the really dramatic elections this past November, even more dramatic than Minnesota, if that's possible to imagine. And that's the Senate race in Alaska. There's been a whistleblower emerging saying that the prosecution in the case against Ted Stevens, the senator from Alaska, the Republican, withheld crucial evidence.
Right, and there's an FBI agent who's talking about that, too. There's some complaints that the Justice Department did not let all the information out that should have been available to the jury, to the defense. Now, of course, that won't undo the election results where the Democrat Mark Begich defeated Ted Stevens, who had been the longest-serving Republican, but it does put some question on the tactics, the Justice Department, the government's case against Ted Stevens. And, of course, that Ted Stevens' name is one of the names that have come up for a possible pardon by President Bush. Obviously, the names released yesterday were of no major significance. But, of course, Louis Libby, the former chief of staff for Vice President Cheney, and Ted Stevens are the names at the top of that list.
And as we go through this, there has been a completion of the Obama cabinet. Nevertheless, the first thing that the transition team had to do was respond to the mess in Illinois, where there were all questions about who had spoken with Rod Blagojevich or his chief of staff about the open Senate seat. What did they know, and when did they know it?
Well, ultimately, I think this was much ado about nothing because, well, first of all, very interesting that the Obama team put out a report clearing its own team on improper conduct.
But amazing how that happens.
Well, but having said, I mean, of course, you know, imagine the Bush people doing that. But having said that, there does not seem to be any improper or unethical contacts between Team Obama and Team Blagojevich. Rahm Emanuel, the congressman from Illinois, who was going to be Obama's new chief of staff, made two phone calls to the governor, four phone calls to the governor's chief of staff, John Harris, both of whom were arrested on December 9th. But again, there was no quid pro quo. There was nothing, no deals being made. But, you know, so the fact had Rahm Emanuel, who's a real Wheeler dealer, not spoken to anybody in the governor's office about the Senate seat, that would have
raised questions. That would have been news.
That would have been surprising. But ultimately, I think it was much, you know, it was greatly anticipated, the report, but ultimately, I think it just said that, you know, they spoke several times, nothing improper, nothing unethical.
The FBI, though, did speak with the president-elect.
Yes, and we didn't know that until the report came out. They spoke to him last Tuesday, I believe, at the president-elect's office in Chicago. They also met, I think, with Valerie Jarrett, whose name had come up as a possible Senate choice, but of course she'll stay in the working with the new White House. And I think David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel also spoke to Patrick Fitzgerald.
And the prosecutor's office there in Chicago said the president-elect is not a target. Of course, he hasn't selected Jesse Jackson Jr. as a target either. And, well, his name has certainly come up in relation to, well, candidate five, who may or may not have offered, at least according to Blagojevich's transcripts, just Blagojevich's side of the story, some money for the Senate seat.
And also, it was very interesting that Blagojevich actually met the press or didn't take any questions, but he spoke to the press last week. And, you know, one would have thought that after the dramatic arrest on December 9th that Blagojevich was not long for this world, let alone the governorship of Illinois. But he said he was going to fight. He said he was going to stand and fight. And ultimately, some people are questioning whether there was a real case that Fitzgerald had. Obviously, the U.S. attorney wanted to move early because he didn't want a U.S. Senate seat offered and tainted in the process. But some people saying that if it's just, you know, if it's just conversations on the phone, Blagojevich and with his very canny lawyers can fight this out for perhaps a long time. So there may be no resolve soon, both about Blagojevich's fate and the next senator from Illinois.
Still, there has to be some. A cynic might say he's looked at the situation and say, hey, you know, this resignation's got to be worth something.
Exactly. Bleeping something.
Bleeping something. And finally, we have the prospective Secretary of State, the current junior senator from the state of New York, Hillary Clinton, retiring her campaign debt.
Well, swallowing her debt, actually, $13.2 million. I mean, you know, from the moment she dropped out of the race in June for the Democratic presidential nomination, there was no shortage of ways she was trying to raise the money. There were fundraising appeals by her mother, by her daughter. They would come into reporters and journalists and Democratic activists' mailbox all the time. But ultimately, I think the time has expired. She can no longer raise money for this. And so the $13.2 million, she'll just have to swallow that. And of course, Bill Clinton has raised millions and millions of dollars with speeches and things like that. So it's not that the Clintons are hurting, but again, she was hoping to have either the Clinton apparatus or the Obama team help erase that debt, and she's stuck with $13.2 million of it.
Also, we learned this week expands for a new, expanded, and better secretary, State Department with not one but two deputy secretaries of state, one to think great thoughts, and the other one to run the place on a day-to-day basis.
She's going to have her own. Hillary Clinton will have her own power structure at Foggy Bottom. Absolutely.
All right, Ken Rudin, stay with us. The Political Junkie visits us every Wednesday. This week, we're talking about the great political moments of 2008, a year that began really in Iowa 355 days ago.
But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
Then Senator Barack Obama claiming victory in the Iowa caucuses, which rocketed him on the way to the Democratic presidential nomination. No, you can't pick that as the most telling moment of 2008. It's stipulated. We're done with it. Pick something else. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. The political junkie Ken Rudin stays with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know you're cooking your holiday meals, wrapping presents, and sneaking a little eggnog, but we have an email challenge for you. Take a break to tell us about your most memorable holiday reunion, be it family, high school, fraternity. Tell us what burned it into your memory. Drop us a line, talk@npr.org. Tune in tomorrow at this time to share your memories with us. It would take a year to go through the most memorable political moments of 2008, but don't worry, political junkie Ken Rudin is here, and he talks really fast. Tell us your favorite moment, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And, we already wrote off Barack Obama, Ken Rudin, so what is the next most amazing political moment of the year for you?
Well, I mean, the fact is also, in addition to Barack Obama, because a lot of us thought that Hillary Clinton would be the nominee. Same with John McCain. We thought that he was down and out in 2007. He had no money. He had staff dissension. He was on the wrong side of many issues among many Republicans. I thought Mitt Romney was going to be the nominee. Others thought Rudy Giuliani. Even Fred Thompson, which sounds so funny now, but some people were touting him. So the fact is that two people who were almost counted out, well, certainly McCain was counted out in 2008, and Obama never
was dismissed.
Dismissed, exactly, given the fact that there was a Hillary Clinton juggernaut. So the fact that we had those two candidates was amazing in itself. But we also had these Senate races, people who were clearly going to win, fell. Bill Jefferson is a perfect example. A Vietnamese American Republican in Africa, an overwhelmingly African American New Orleans.
Elizabeth Dole,
who again they couldn't get a decent Democrat to run against her. Nobody ever heard of Kay Hagan before.
Are you suggesting she's an indecent Democrat?
No, I'm just saying that they couldn't find anybody. And yet, which shows you that the election that matters is November 4th. It's not the year before. It's not months before. It's every day counts. And we,
so
we
can we start going through the polls for 2012 now?
See, that's the thing that always drove me nuts. We were talking about front runners when voters never even had a say. So, you know, don't. I guess the lesson is don't discount the wisdom of the voters.
Let's get some of those voters on the line. 800-989-8255. Brad joins us on the line from Denver.
Hi. I'm wondering if you put the pop culture phenomenon of Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin aside, I'm wondering what the impact was of the Saturday Night Live skits about her, because they so withheld her from the media, and she was an unknown. And I'm wondering, I guess, two questions is, one, how much did Tina Fey's portrayal of her define who Sarah Palin was? And secondarily, did putting her on the ticket really have, in the long run, much of an effect on the outcome of the election?
Brad, hold on. I'm going to play a piece of tape for you. Listen to this cut of tape.
As Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border. It is from Alaska that we send those out to make sure that an eye is being kept on this very powerful nation, Russia, because they are right there. They are right next to our state.
Okay. Palin or Fey?
I would have to guess Palin, but the fact that I'm not sure says a lot.
You are absolutely right, Brad. And Ken, it does say a lot.
That's exactly right. I mean, there was a time when Sarah Palin's pick did energize the Republican Party, did give a big boost to the Republican ticket. John McCain, who was counted out, seemed to have come back. But ultimately, the fact that very few people knew who Sarah Palin was, and if the satirists could define Sarah Palin before the Republicans could, and that's exactly what happened, I think that's part of the problem. Of course, I think the Republicans and the economy, I think that's probably ultimately what decided this election. But any positive effect that Sarah Palin might have had, I think disappeared once the satirists took control.
Brad, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Siobhan in San Francisco on the same point. The nomination of Sarah Palin is what sealed John McCain's fate. I can't tell you the number of people who'd been on the fence until that moment, relatives and friends all over the country, when they took a careful look at his running mate, something he really should have done too. They questioned his judgment to the point where they just couldn't vote for him. Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to Mary. Mary with us from Birmingham, Alabama.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be on the show. I would like to say that I think one of the defining political moments, other than obviously the election of Barack Obama, was actually John McCain's concession speech, because I felt that he had been very aggressive during his campaign, but his concession speech was full of grace and just absolutely made me feel like the Republican Party and John McCain, as a representative of that party, really did want to work together to just further the American people and fix some of the problems that we're having.
And here is John McCain conceding on election night.
I urge all Americans who supported me to join me in not just congratulating him, but offering our next president our goodwill and earnest effort to find ways to come together.
And Ken, it's interesting what Mary is saying. Through the campaign, a candidate speaks through so many different voices, all the different speech writers, all the different consultants and the pollsters and all of that. Here he was speaking back in Mark Salter's voice, a man with whom he is extremely comfortable, who is extremely comfortable with him, who co-wrote his books, and he sounded like himself again.
Well, I was going to say exactly that. I think this is exactly the John McCain that a lot of people saw and liked in 2000. And though that maverick voice you heard of McCain in the past seemed to be subsumed in 2008 by the fact that many Republicans didn't trust him, that he had to win over many Bush Republicans, and you almost wondered what voice you were hearing from John McCain. The dialogue got nasty, the rhetoric got ugly, and yet I think the finest moment in many politicians' cases, but certainly with John McCain, was on that concession speech that night.
Mary, it's a great point. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right, let's go now. This is Mike, and Mike with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
No, you were asking about the singular most important political moment in the year of 2008.
Yes.
And again, I would declare that it's Oprah Winfrey's public endorsement of Barack Obama, particularly in front of a large crowd in Iowa.
Oprah Winfrey's?
Yes.
That was a big moment, Ken. Oprah Winfrey, obviously, absolute magnet for so many people on television every single day, had never endorsed a presidential candidate before.
Right. I think ultimately, I think endorsements are overrated. Remember when Ted Kennedy endorsed Barack Obama, which was very played up by the national press. But of course, Hillary Clinton won the Massachusetts primary overwhelmingly. But having said that, I think the Winfrey endorsement seemed to really generate a lot of people, including many African Americans who said, well, I'm excited about Obama, but I don't think he could win. And I think for the first time they said, well, maybe we can, maybe he can. And I think that was the beginning of a momentum.
Maybe this is something beyond politics. Maybe this is sweeping into some sort of big mass movement, which is indeed what the Obama campaign became.
And I think if you looked at what happened in South Carolina, of course, you know, Obama won Iowa, lost New Hampshire, but winning South Carolina, I think, was a remarkable thing. And the speech he gave everything, it basically put race and politics, which have often been at odds with each other, put it in the same page on that night.
Well, another thing that happened in Carolina was seemingly off the cuff. By the way, Mike, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, let me add that one thing, that when Oprah appeared in Iowa.
Yes.
She drew, I don't know, it was well over 30,000 people. You know, that's very, very significant. That brought a lot of people into the door for Obama. That really put him on center stage. Just that singular appearance by her.
Okay.
That endorsement. I think that was huge.
Thanks very much, Mike.
You're welcome.
I was mentioning another thing that happened in South Carolina after Barack Obama won was a comment apparently off the cuff by former President Bill Clinton.
Jesse Jackson won South Carolina twice in 84 and 88. And he ran a good campaign, and Senator Obama's run a good campaign here.
There was a time when Bill Clinton was identified as America's first black president. I'm not sure a lot of African Americans will ever see him quite the same way.
Well, it certainly brought race back into the campaign. Not that the thought of Barack Obama as a leading Democratic candidate meant that race would not be part of it. But I think for Bill Clinton, who was looked upon so favorably by so many African Americans, the fact that he sounded like he was dismissing Barack Obama's victory in South Carolina, said, well, Jesse Jackson won there twice anyways, so you know, it doesn't mean that much. I think that almost put Bill Clinton, for the first time, you wondered whether he was actually helping his wife win the Democratic nomination or not.
Let's get Sarah on the line. Sarah with us from Vermilion in South Dakota.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I have to nominate Ted Kennedy's return to the Senate floor in July.
An extremely moving moment. Of course, Senator Kennedy diagnosed with a brain tumor, an operation that I don't know how good his prospects are, but he came back to the United States Senate, then made a very moving appearance also at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, and I don't know if people really truly appreciated how much he's done for the country until we heard people on both sides of the aisle just really getting emotional about how much he's done and what a player he's been and what a fighter he's been. And I still get a little choked up when I think about it.
All right. Sarah, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Patricia. Patricia is in Bemidji in Minnesota. Bemidji.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Believe what they wrote on my screen here, but go ahead.
Am I on?
Yes, you're on. Go ahead.
I think the most laughable moment for politics is that the canvassing board here in Minnesota counted missing ballots in a recount. A hand recount is to count ballots that exist, but they decided to count ballots that they don't even have. And I think that's just laughable.
It's a long, slow developing laugh. One of those big belly laughs, maybe. It'll erupt sometime in January.
No, I think that it's just a downright, outright laugh. That the purpose for a recount is to count ballots that are right before you, but these ones, these phantom ballots, have been counted, and I that's just unbelievable. I can't believe that Minnesota has done this.
Ken?
Well, there's a similar election in New Hampshire in 1974 that was so disputed that it had to go to a special election. But during the recount in New Hampshire in 1974, one of the ballots said Crook. It the guy's name, they wrote in the name Crook, and both the candidates, both the Republican candidate and Democrat, fought for that ballot.
So you're clearly referring to me.
That shows how close and how tightly fought that battle was.
Patricia, we're all here with bated breath.
Pardon?
We're all here with bated breath awaiting the news from the final tally and then, of course, the news of who's going to file the first lawsuit. Bye-bye. Have a happy Christmas.
You too.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can go to one last caller. And this is going to be Andrew. Andrew with us from Phoenix.
Yes. My favorite single most important moment of 2008 is when Ron Paul was banned from the Republican convention in St. Paul because this signified the death of the religious right stranglehold on the Republican Party, ultimately leading to the Goldwater Republicans' rejection of John McCain as a valid president.
Come again?
Was Ron Paul, he was banned from the Republican...
That part I got. I'm not sure how it signified what you thought it signified.
It signified the death of the religious right.
In the Republican Party?
Yeah, their stranglehold on the Republican Party is no more.
Okay, we'll have to wait to see 4 years from now. But they're still a very big part of the Republican base. And I think if you talk to people like former Governor Huckabee, I think he might disagree with you.
Well, I think from Arizona, we'll see when Goldwater runs for the governor. If he makes governor out here, then that pretty much signifies the death.
All right. Andrew, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Here's finally an email from Andrew in Greensboro, North Carolina. The most important political moment of the year, CNN's famous election night hologram. So Will.i.am, for some reason they picked Will.i.am and not Ken Rudin. I can't believe that.
Well, I think Blitzen is part of that. Twas the Night Before Christmas. I think Blitzen is in there. Isn't it Wolf Blitzen?
Wolf Blitzen. Yes, we'll get to that in just a moment. We're talking with the political junkie. Who else? It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ken, before we wrap up this year-end segment, because Ken's not going to be with us next week, he's taking a day off, deserved or not, we did want to go through some of the people who we lost in 2008, some of the great politicians and not-so-great politicians who will not be with us from now on.
Well, I put together a little list. I mean, later in my Political Junkie column, I'll have a humongous list. But every year, there are some people who I think made a difference. Tom Lantos was the first Holocaust survivor who was in Congress. He rose to be chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee. Foreign Affairs Committee. Howard Metzelbaum was a three-term senator from Ohio, fought big business, you know, stood up for labor. William F. Buckley, the conservative columnist, he was a conservative when there were no conservatives. This is 1950s.
Credited as the grandfather of
exactly. Tim Russert, who probably the epitome of journalism and the confluence of journalism and politics, died before one of the greatest, you know, before the results of the greatest election of all time.
Let's not forget that Tony Snow, before he was White House press secretary, a journalist for
Tony
a very
Snow,
long time.
53 years old. It was very tragic to see what happened to him. Stephanie Tubbs Jones, the Ohio congresswoman, died at the age of 58. Mark Felt, the answer to a trivia question. We always wondered who was going to be the answer. Who was Deep Throat, died at the age of 95.
Follow the money, Ken.
Exactly. Hamilton Jordan, he's the one who put together the road to Jimmy Carter being elected governor of Georgia and then president in 1976. Jesse Helms, the five-term unwielding conservative, unyielding conservative.
Unyielding.
Unyielding, not unwielding.
He wielded quite a bit.
You wabbit, from North Carolina. Let's see, there. Earl Butz, who of course was known
agriculture secretary
under Nixon and Ford. Evan Meekum was the impeached governor of Arizona, very influential conservative there.
I look on your list and I see the name of, well, it's a curious name. It's Charlton Heston.
Well, Charlton Heston, of course, the actor, of course, and you know, I think for many reasons, but of course he later became the head of the NRA, very influential on conservative causes, on issue of guns and things like that. But Charlton Heston, the actor who became a political operative. And, of course, Madeleine Dunham, who doesn't sound like a political person. You may not recognize her name, but she was Barack Obama's grandmother who raised her and said to say that she died 2 days before her grandson was to be elected president of the United States.
One other name I see on your list, I'm not sure you got to it, Margaret Truman Daniel.
Right, the only child of Harry Truman. I incorrectly said last week on this show that she was a piano player and not a singer. She was probably terrible at either one, and of course she got booed. She got a very ugly review by somebody, and Harry Truman castigated that reviewer for the, but Margaret Truman Daniel was, I think, 95 years old, also the only child of Harry Truman, the only president with a fake middle name.
Okay, Ken Rudin is with us every Wednesday, except for next Wednesday as the political junkie. But we're going to ask him to stay over because in our next segment, we want to hear your rewrite of "Twas the Night Before Christmas." Make it your own, and if you can rhyme, radio extra points. Ken will have his own version of "Twas the Night Before Christmas." So give us a call, 800-989-8255. Or zap it to us by email. That's talk@npr.org. You can also find doggerel on our website and post your own. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us.